Hello, and welcome to all of our listeners, new ones, existing ones. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Rabia, I'm the Customer Support Manager here at Charity Digital, and I'm really excited to be hosting today's podcast. Just a few housekeeping things before we jump in. I have travelled to London today to take advantage of the strong office Wi-Fi, and I'd like to apologise for any London sounds, such as sirens or colourful characters in the background. Sometimes we can even hear the local church chiming, so I'd apologise for any sort of unexpected sounds in the background. Today, we're going to be looking at the findings of the Global Online Fundraising Scorecard report carried out by Salesforce and Next After. In this sector, most of us realise that most charities require donations to deliver their services. This in-depth, extensively researched study from Salesforce and Next After takes a close look at online fundraising through the perspective of the donor and seeks to establish how we can develop a benchmark for the user experience and suggests ways in which charities can turn one-time donors into repeat supporters. I'm sure that's something that we're all sort of thinking about at this time. I'm very pleased to welcome and introduce our speakers. We are joined by Andrea Gozin, the Product Marketing Manager at Salesforce.org, and Brady Josephson, the Managing Director of the Next After Institute. Hello, both. How are you doing?
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. Over here in the UK, I know you guys are joining internationally. Over at this end, we're very excited about lockdown lifting, and the country's full of, enthusiasm going out for haircuts, visiting friends. Is there a fun thing you've been able to do this week? Is sort of lockdown lifting in your respective locations?
So I got a haircut.
Oh.
And the first thing my twin boy said, "Why did you do that?" So I'm excited about my haircut personally, but I'm still convincing my
It's a very personal thing, a haircut.
voice.
Just reading the news from, so I'm based in the US, so just reading the news, I just get this perception that especially people in the UK love haircuts. Like it shows up all the time. Everyone's just showing pictures of getting haircuts and things like that. So it's I'm happy for you all getting your haircut. That's great.
Thank you. We have our peculiar passions, and they're very important to us.
Yeah, it's something I'm learning. I'm based in actually Texas, so US is its own thing, and Texas within the United States is its own thing. So, for better or worse, we've been able to get our haircuts for quite a while here. So it's I got my vaccine, so that's the good news, I
Oh,
guess.
that's great.
Yeah,
Well done.
part one of two. I need the other
Oh,
one still,
nice.
but.
Yes. So that's great news. Glad to hear it. I'm still waiting for mine to come round. So, coming back to our study, I really enjoyed reading it, and the stats were just very, very impressive. Can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you approached this study?
So, I'm Andrea Gozin. I'm Product Marketing Manager at Salesforce.org. And we started this study before the pandemic, so BC, in December 2019. And we really wanted to have the experience of a mystery donor. So, this is how we refer to the study more colloquially. And I've been working in the sector for a long time, and I've always admired the research of the Next After Institute. So they were the first that sprung to mind. And we went into a conversation with Brady and his team, and we started the outline of the study, not knowing how big this was gonna get. So I'm gonna let Brady put a little bit more context to what happened in the last year that we did the study.
Yeah, we didn't really know what we were getting into when we signed on to this project with Andrea and Salesforce.org. But the Next After Institute, our mission is to decode what works in fundraising and make it as accessible as we can to as many organizations as we can. And so we do that through research. So we've got two types of research. One is experimentation and testing. So A/B tests, we have over 2,700 tests documented in our library from real nonprofits, primarily in Canada and the US, trying to get more outside of the US in there. And we're trying to understand donor behavior. What do donors do, particularly when it comes to online fundraising? Because a lot of it's counterintuitive. And then we do these research studies where we become a donor or an email subscriber, in this case, both, to understand what is it that nonprofits are doing or what are they not doing, to try to figure out if we can find this gap between what works in fundraising and what nonprofits are doing or not doing. That's where we can focus our time, energy, and attention. to improve generosity, giving in the online experience overall. So that's really what we did for this study. Just kind of two bits of context. We made $20 donations or equivalent. So in the UK, we made £20 donations to 80 organizations. There's 630 in 9 countries, 6 languages around the world, all around the same time. Different donor, different email subscriber, and we track them different phone numbers, different email addresses. And then we captured those emails for 90 days to figure out what was the online giving experience for an online donor and what was the email signup experience for an email subscriber. Tried to wrap all those 97,000 plus data points up into one semi-cohesive report that you have read through. So, and that's made free but from Salesforce. So it was a huge, huge undertaking, by far the biggest research project that we've undertook. So it was fun, but a big challenge.
If I could just jump in, I'd like to ask, given the scale of this report and all of the findings you found, could you tell us a little bit about why you feel it's important for charities to be aware of this sort of information?
So for Salesforce.org, one of the 4 values that Salesforce lead with is customer success. And I think what is important to realize that a lot of decisions, either consciously or unconsciously, are sometimes made sort of in the spur of the moment or based not really on testing. And so my favorite phrase, and Brady knows this, is test, 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 and next after really, really embodies it. And I think it's important for charities to really make data-driven decisions. And we were able in the position to do this kind of research and make it available to the sector. And we hope that that will lead to the sector fundraise more and have more impact, especially now during the pandemic, when the amount of demand is increasing exponentially and most charities still have to work with the same or less amount of resources. So this is one of the driving factors behind doing this study with Brady and his team.
Yeah, and I just build on that saying there's 2 real things. I mean, there's any number of things nonprofits can and should do, but it's the prioritization, right? Time and resources are limited, and it's prioritization that's most critical. So if we can get a kind of bigger picture view of the issues or challenges that nonprofits face in the donor experience, then hopefully we can articulate, here's where we should be focusing some time, energy, and attention. There's a lot of really interesting conversations around, like, you know, AI and automation and these kinds of things. And it's really interesting and important. But we'll do this study and we can't even complete donations 20% of the time. Only 75% of charities in the UK thanked the donor for making a donation. So there is some basics of just like the blocking and tackling of sorts of what it means to be running a fundraising program that we're not doing. And so it's kind of shining a light to say, like, look, we have to do some of these basic things. As cool as some of those things are, if we don't do some of these underlying basic things, that's almost irrelevant. So, you know, we can kind of go into our conference mode and listen to podcasts and kind of get ahead of ourselves. And so it's a bit of a reality check to see where are we actually at for the user experience. And we should also say these are larger charities in the UK and around the world. You know, almost all of them had revenues of 10 million and plus. Most of them, almost all of them, had $5 million in revenue and above. So we're not necessarily dealing with smaller and even medium-sized nonprofits either. So, you know, to see those types of numbers and metrics with generally larger organizations, it's definitely a reality check.
It's so interesting you say that, because it's sort of listening to both of you outline your insights about the report, it sort of really makes me wonder about the significance of this sort of user experience and how it really reflects how the donor is being valued or how the donor may respond and how this might shape the kind of interaction between the donor and the charity. So, you know, you're seeking supporters, but if there's kind of these sort of hurdles and stumbling blocks in the way to completing donations, it's really going to sort of affect how they're interacting with the charity's sort of work and its mission and things. Would you agree a bit with that?
Yes, hugely. You know, when we look at what drives kind of future engagement and kind of donor commitment or loyalty, trust is a huge factor. You know, if you don't trust an organization, you won't give to it. But trust isn't like a fixed state. It goes up and down based on your interactions with that organization. And so, you know, if you make a donation, you may feel this sense of trust. You may feel this sense of kind of, you know, this warm glow, I just made this nice donation. And then if you get zero communications, or you don't get thanked, or you get treated as just kind of a number in a database, your trust erodes. And this is why we see these types of donor attrition rates that are pretty astronomical for the most part. I don't know exactly what they are in the UK, but the United States, first-time donor retention rates are about 20%. You know, it's very, very low, and it's been that way for almost 10, 15 years. So we have to focus more on what are these drivers of trust and commitment and loyalty. And it does start with valuing the donor as a human, as a person, for their gift. And we can talk about it all day long, but what we see, again, our systems, our tools, our strategies aren't actually implementing that to the degree that we think it should be done.
Great. Thank you so much. So I'm going to turn to you, Andrea, briefly and ask you, based on the findings that we've found in the report, could you tell us a little bit about what sort of charities can do, how they can shake up their existing systems, what they can do more of and what they can avoid to sort of help donors feel valued, help encourage that sort of sense of trust that Brady refers to?
I think one thing that I've really noticed is that charities have always been very channel-centric. So we look at what is the amount we fundraised with this specific channel, be it direct mail, be it events, be it community fundraising, be it TV. But it really needs a shift to focusing on the donor. And in the sense of being donor-centric, it doesn't only mean that you want the organization to really surface whatever the donor is interested in, but more that you provide a full experience. So the donor will be interacting with you on multiple channels. And what we really just see is that if you devise a strategy that caters more to how the donor interacts, and that you can find out through data and through testing, that you also have much more loyalty of your donor. So your supporters will stay with you longer term, and that has lots and lots of side effects. As a charity, you can start really, really basic. You don't need super complicated things. What Brady already said, like even just, I usually did that actually when I was still working at charities, even have some people in your direct environment making a donation and going through that mystery experience. I usually did with my mother, but lately I've been trying to put it a little bit more wider circle, a little bit more people that might not be so close to you and are willing to tell you the truth about how they feel when they receive communication from your organization. And that is just the basic research of being a mystery donor yourself already gives quite a lot of information. And I'll let Brady fill a little bit more what organizations can do.
You know, one of the kind of drivers of human behavior, kind of, we all want to feel competent. We all want to feel like we have a sense of autonomy, and then we all want a sense of connection, right? These are like three underlying things. And so as nonprofits, we need to be thinking about how can we use our communications and in our marketing to achieve those things in the lives of our donors. And the connectedness piece is one that I think we talk a lot, but we don't actually do a lot. And some of the thing that we look at is even just how emails are designed or communicated. And, you know, more than half of the emails that we received didn't even call us by name, even though they definitely had our name, as long as they captured on the email sign up, and they definitely had it when we made an online donation. So, I mean, very simple things of just referencing someone's name. There's huge power in someone's name. Even how we design emails, 99.9% of the emails that we received of the 6,000 were heavily designed emails, had designed elements, big logos, big banners, big buttons. And what our research in the US suggests that for fundraising, you shouldn't have any of those elements, actually. It should be stripped down, plain text emails like you'd write in Gmail or Outlook and send it to thousands of people. So even if you don't go all the way that approach, but we're communicating through all of our design, all of our frequency, all the time. And what you kind of walk away with from a donor perspective is, I don't know how kind of communal relationship this is. It does feel a lot more transactional, right? Like, you need my money, therefore you ask me for money. And we need as best we can to kind of step away and be like, how do we add to people's lives around the sense of connectedness in particular? Particularly during a pandemic. I think that's part of the reason why we saw the resiliency of giving, is it was a way for people to feel connected. Is I'm trapped in my home, but I can make a donation. I can contribute to someone who's doing the work on the front lines, or, you know, keep this organization running that's helping people. Like, we have this sense of connectedness. And I think it's something we possess as charities and nonprofits that we need to leverage more in our communications, all the way from tone, message, and design to frequency.
Go on, Andrea. I think you were going to say something.
No, I just want to jump on the point that Brady brought about the pandemic, because I thought it was really interesting, because the mystery donor study is something that we did together. But for the last decade or so, I think a lot of people at Salesforce and also at NextAfter have been donors themselves and have on so many lists. And in the beginning of the pandemic, I got it really reduced. So I was really interested by that phenomenon, by nonprofits were sending less instead of more, because for me, what Brady just said really hits home. In addition to feeling connected, it also felt empowering that I could still do something, even though we were in lockdown here in Switzerland. I think that power that we have as the charity sector to make people feel like they can make a difference sometimes internally gets confused as like we're asking too much of them, we're sending out too much information, we're bothering them. I hear some of that rhetoric, and we really don't. Like, if the communication is authentic and about the impact, then I really want to hear from you as a donor. Like, if I made a donation to change something, I really want to know how it changed. And if you tell me that, you definitely are not bothering me. And I'm saying that from my role as a donor.
So it sounds like what really matters to sort of donors, as Brady mentions, this sense of connectedness. And as Andrea, you've talked about, you know, people feeling they can still do something even though they can't physically move around. It sort of seems to come back to the importance and the value of these kind of genuine, authentic emails and communications where you really are sort of forging an emotional relationship with the charity, and the significance of aspects such as naming your donors and your communications with them, really creating the sense of, you know, we're in this together, and how important it is for charities to build on that sort of sense in the communications. And that sort of glossy campaigns with, you know, logos and designs are great and they're eye-catching, but the things that people respond to, your data is showing, is sort of almost text-based kind of output. People are responding to stories. People want to hear more about what their donations are actually doing for the service users. So could you maybe tell us, either one of you could jump in and tell us a little bit more about how charities could use their communications to foster more of this kind of genuine emotional connection with their supporters?
Yeah, well, first, I should say, you know, on the design front, it's definitely something we're testing. I think too often we just say, oh, well, this organization does design, and I think I like design emails, so let's just send heavily designed emails. And soon everyone is sending heavily designed emails with no one actually knowing if this actually helps on the other side or not. So it's not like there's not a case for design. That's not necessarily.
It's your data, isn't it? Like.
Yeah, and more so is just saying, like, what's the point of an email? You want to establish a connection and move someone to action. If the design supports that, great. And if it doesn't, remove it. That's what we should be thinking about. I think the other kind of thing is that we think about in kind of emails and communications is, one, you need to engage when they're engaged. And that's typically right after their donation. Right. So there's this maybe sense of like, oh, they just gave, let's leave them alone. And to Andrea's point is like, if you just met someone and had this great date, it's not like, oh, I need to leave them alone for 3 months now. Right. It's like, no, let's build this relationship while it's positive and engagement. And so when we look in the US, tied to recurring, the most likely time someone is to upgrade from a one-time donation to a recurring donation is within the first 2 to 4 weeks after a one-time donation. And it's maybe counterintuitive. I'm not saying go out and just blast a bunch of solicitations in the first 4 weeks. I am saying this is an engagement period where they are connected to your organization, and this is a ripe opportunity. And so one of the stats that we used in the study is how many emails were sent within the first 14 days after email sign up and after donation, because this is a very prime time to engage while they're engaged. So if you want to do a satisfaction survey, if you want to say, here's more about us, if you want to say, how did you hear about us, if you want to use more of these relational tactics, this is a key time period with which to do it. And what we saw is, on average, there was 2 emails sent in the first 14 days. The first one is almost always a confirmation. Thank you, you're subscribed, or thank you for your gift, which means there's not a lot of front-loaded communications. And it's impossible to say for sure, but we don't see a lot of automated kind of onboarding series, at least in the first 14 days. And there's a way to do that in a nice, personal, engaging way to make sure that they have a great experience in this very critical first time, and not this temptation to like, let's leave them alone for a few months, because by the time you re-engage, they could be gone. They may never open your email again. So this early time period is really, really critical.
Yeah, and I think there you have some advantage of automating things, because the beginning of the relationship with a new supporter is something that you can, I mean, every charity, I think by now, have heard of a welcome journey for the donor, but it's something that once you've set it up, you can reuse. You have to always tweak it. You can't leave it for the next decade the same, but it's something that's for each new supporter will be new content. So once you've automated it, it's relatively easy to put in place. And it's something that is with so much value long-term. We see that donors that received a welcome journey stay with the organization much longer. They will have a much higher lifetime value in terms of donation they give. They will also be much more engaged, so much more likely to take part in the peer-to-peer fundraising virtually or in person, that do any kind of other activities for the nonprofit. And we really see the importance of that beginning of the relationship. And like Brady said, it's like in real life. Don't let your date wait for 3 months until you call them back.
Amazing. Thank you both so much. It's such an interesting kind of meeting point of sort of data and numbers and that kind of human aspect of tapping into how people are feeling, tapping into when the connection is still sort of holistic and real and when you can kind of make the most of that. So you mentioned a little bit, Andrea, about the welcome journey. Could you tell us a little bit more about what that sort of looks like, please?
Well, a welcome journey can be really sophisticated and it can be really basic, but the basic element of it is just to start the relationship. So usually it's somewhere in the period of 3 weeks, anywhere between 3 and 6 emails. One email is just really to confirm, to thank, but also to get to know the donor. So I've been doing several projects now. Salesforce.org also allows us to work as a pro bono person, so we look at, for example, one of those emails, usually not the first one, but one in the later the journey, to have a questionnaire like, what are you interested in as a supporter? Like a lot of organizations have more than one project. Maybe it's something specific that drew your attention. And based on that, you can then build further journeys that go into that interest of your new supporter. I think Next After has a really great image of how you can devise a basic donor journey. But again, I'm going to come back to my first point, which is test, 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 because I've seen about over 1,000 donor databases, and the charity sector is wonderfully diverse, and some donor databases are just not the same. So test what responds with your supporters. I'm actually now working on a pro bono project where the donor database is majority male and around 40, which is not your common donor database. And I find it really interesting to see the results. Brady, do you want to talk a little bit more to the donor journey?
Yeah, I think, the one starting point is something generally speaking is better than nothing. And again, our experience as a donor or user was there would be huge gaps of communication and there'd be not a lot of communication. So there's a hesitancy sometimes to like, oh, we don't want to get it wrong. And then we do nothing. So we'd say, having 3 automated emails that go out in the first 14, 21 days or something like that, it's better than nothing, which is maybe what you're giving them already. So start there and then figure out how can we improve. And we're actually doing a research project with the Institute of Sustainable Philanthropy in the UK right now, looking at 30 new donor welcome series and what they're doing or not doing, and trying to underpin that with what we know about donor and human behavior. How do we build up things like trust and commitment in this communal relationship? And then we're going to devise basically a new roadmap for a welcome series, because it can't just be, oh, let's just fire 4 emails out or even just a survey. That's great. But what are we trying to do? And one of the things that you're trying to do is make sure that the donor is valued or heard. And one of the ways to do that is just by having a survey or just saying, we want to hear from you. Or we'll often do a reply email to say like, hey, just reply back to this email. How'd you hear about us? Or what inspired your gift? And then you get this, oh, there's a human on the other side of this email and they want to hear from me. And it's amazing what that does for future engagement, because so much of the communication we receive from brands, charity and non, it is really one way, right? Buy our stuff, give to us, and you don't even think about the fact that there's a human on the other side. So there's more research to be done, but again, the main thing is, like, all we're trying to do is get engagement, right? We know that the more engaged a donor is, the more likely they are to actually give if and when we ask. And we know that that's a critical thing moving forward to driving kind of donor loyalty and commitment into the future. So if that's a survey, if it's a reply back, if it's a change in tone, if it's a change in design, to Andrea's point, I don't know what that is for your organization, but if we understand what's the main goal here to foster engagement, then, you know, there's smart people working at nonprofits. You can figure it out, but know that it's a hugely important time period and that there's different ways to go about that goal. And it's not just, here's more about us, here's more about us, here's action you can take. It needs to be a lot more two-way.
Yeah, and I think that really comes back to the point earlier, to move from channel-centric to donor-centric. And you can do that through simple tools like personas, like give them a name and what they like. So you build maybe very simple journey that you automate. It will take some time in the beginning, but once it automated, it will run. So on day one, you just say, thank you, welcome. You align your beliefs because the donor probably aligns with your values and your mission as an organization. Then on like day four, you give some information about what you're doing. Then like day seven, maybe give something of value. I find this extremely interesting in the study because it seems that like every nonprofit just copied this footer at the bottom of the website from each other, where it's just, if we're lucky, it has the name, but usually it's just where you can fill in your email address to sign up to the newsletter. And what we found is that any type of other content, so ebooks or even podcasts, or anything that has a little bit more value in terms of an ebook has several pages, it has more content, will convert better. So on day seven, maybe give some of that wonderful content that you have before working in tech, is working on the creative side of it. And I've seen so many beautiful pictures that have never been sent to supporters. And then after 2 weeks, you can do a cultivation, a response opportunity. It can be like sign a petition or anything to engage. And then after maybe 2 to 3 weeks, you can also do a donation ask. Although from our research, we found you can even do it earlier.
Thank you so much for explaining that. So sort of listening to both of you kind of talk about, you know, the importance of remaining in touch with your supporters, keep sort of testing, build a human aspect. It sounds to me as if there's these kind of tried and tested things at work, but you can't sort of, you know, do this and then expect the same results because your supporter group is different. Andrea, as you mentioned, you've got one pool of sort of men in their 40s, which may not necessarily be the same as if you're trying to track support from women in their 20s. So it's kind of, there's the things at work, but it also sounds a lot like driving engagement requires for you to be engaged with your donors, for you to keep fostering and investing in that relationship, sort of keep testing, keep building this sense of trust. And it's the sort of a two-way dialogue that I think, Brady, you mentioned, and the significance of that in sort of getting donors to come back and remain on that journey with you. And that if you do, you sort of, you know, you mentioned the footer, if everyone has the same footer, it sort of starts to look very, I don't know if corporate is the right word, but I'm going to say something like sort of copied and pasted. And sort of you want to avoid that kind of approach. It sounds like you want to tailor your campaigns and your work to your donors specifically so that they feel that sort of sense of authenticity and they kind of stay with you. And then they're more likely to sort of be repeat donors and kind of be with you through the journey. Am I right about any of this? Am I just rambling? So if either of you could jump in there.
Right, do you want to respond to this
one? Yeah, again, it's funny. I literally just had a conversation with a behavioral scientist based in Greece who works a lot in the UK right before this. And we were talking about the same thing of there's two levels. There's one level that we can absolutely generalize, like who doesn't want more personal communication? Who doesn't want to feel more connected to a cause? Who doesn't want to feel like they're growing and developing as a person? Who doesn't want to feel like they have a sense of purpose and autonomy in the world? Every single human does. So it doesn't matter if you're a woman in your 20s in the UK or a man in your 60s in the United States. These are fundamental underpinnings. So that's the starting point, right? Competence, autonomy, and connectedness, that kind of those core things. And so no matter who you are, we can focus on those things. But then you're right, within that, then there are some different things. You know, 40-year-old males in the UK or in the Netherlands are different than 20-year-old women in the UK. But beyond that, that's just like superficial demographics. The other thing is more like identity, right? So if I tell you I'm a 35-year-old male in Texas, all you know about me is that I'm a 35-year-old male in Texas. You don't know that I'm an adoptive father. You don't know that I've worked in international development. You don't know that I'm actually Canadian. You know, these are things that are more tied to my identity are those things. And you don't know anything about that. So we even need to, you know, persona building and demographics is potentially better than nothing, but it's also very superficial because who the person is a lot more important. So if we start from those universals and then we can find out through things like surveys and monitoring their human behavior and when asking them and watching their activity, we can develop more of like an identity persona based on who they actually are. That's where we want to get to. That's where we need to get to. But everyone, you know, those kind of higher level things we can focus on for sure in terms of, you know, competence, autonomy and connectedness.
Yeah, and I think there's a part that you can automate again. And I find this really interesting looking at how that is done currently in the sector, because a lot of nonprofits do surveys. I even have a great nonprofit where the CEO calls a donor a week. We have great donor care services that I love the people that work there and I love chatting with them, but none of that data is put in the CRM, which I find highly interesting. So for me, when we look with organizations at the more strategic level, which comes with a platform implementation, I think it's interesting to see that part is often forgotten. Like a field like proximity to cause has so much power, but is never really thought about until later. Then you're just hitting the practical things of a technical implementation. The earlier you're implemented, the more data you will have. So I think we're all familiar with having to do some data cleaning at some point in our life or empty fields. So I do encourage even the smallest charity to have a field that is something like a proximity to cause or a reason why they were drawn to the charity, because that will indeed tell you a lot more than if the person is male or female, or if they're from Texas or from Vancouver.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on that. It's so interesting you talk about tracking the data, and we've all done data sets and cleaning things. You know, you're sort of looking at it day after day thinking, I know these numbers mean something, but it's so important to kind of take that kind of qualitative data and make it quantitative and kind of get that analysis and get that breakdown so you can kind of track the relationships and the journeys a bit more. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about how you feel that charities have successfully, or maybe not in your research, been able to use that kind of qualitative data to drive the user engagement in the sort of online fundraising environment? Oh, I'm so sorry, Brady. I'm so sorry. I just kind of say the question and then I forget. So yeah. My apologies. It's bad hosting.
Yeah. No. I was just looking at Andrea like, you or me. This is a much bigger conversation for sure. I think one of the things that we should focus on is, yes, data is important, but there's an over-reliance or an overconfidence in what that data is, right? So we can look at gift array amounts and past giving behavior, and then we can kind of trick ourselves or fool ourselves into thinking that like we know this person or we kind of know what they're going to give. And so that's where the qualitative side is really important. And for us, a lot of that's just actually monitoring their activity. So oftentimes there is something around preferences and letting people say, what are you interested in and how often do you want to receive things? There is some value in that. And part of that's just, again, giving them a voice to be heard. But what we're moving more towards in a lot of our kind of, we're moving even beyond a welcome series. We're doing like cultivation series. There'll be anywhere from 30 to 50 automated emails that a new donor will get in their first year. And it's just all the best emails and content from the past. You know, we spend all this time creating this great email, highly performed, and then we move on with our lives and a new donor has never seen that email, never seen that content. So we're saying, why don't we just repackage some of the best stuff that we know resonates with our ideal donors and just make sure they get something good every 10 days or whatever it might be. And through that, you can see when we talk about, you know, maybe human trafficking and they show interest in that. Well, we monitor those clicks and we can start building a profile and maybe they don't click on work that's more like domestic or whatever that might be. And so through their actions, we can actually learn a lot as well, in addition to maybe some of the surveying type of stuff. And again, the part of it is just the posture of we want to know you is really important. So even if that doesn't make it into a CRM, although it should, even if it doesn't make its way into your marketing, although it should, just this posture again of we care about you, we want to hear from you is something that any organization of any size can start today, whether it's a reply back email or a simple satisfaction survey or whatever it might be. And then it obviously gets a lot more complex, and that's where we probably don't have time to dive into those things. I'm not sure what Andrea would answer, because I know you and your team spend a lot of more time doing this.
I think what charities do really well, and I want to acknowledge especially the charity employees, is that they really, really, really know their cause, and they're really passionate about that. And sometimes I think what happens is that they start to talk as an organization, and that loses that personal element to it. And so the litmus test I have with anyone, CEO, board member, or somebody who's entering donor information, is, would you do that in a relationship? If you're building a friendship, like I've moved about 12 times in my life, I'm Dutch, currently in Switzerland, each time I had to make new friends, would you do that, and would that work? I think charities, once they push that litmus test, are really good at having that relationship building capacity. And the technical infrastructure can definitely support that. We can look where people look on the website. We can see where they're clicking, what they find interesting. We know which blog post got the most views and which performed best on social media. We can also learn from charities in a way is reduce, reuse, recycle. Like, you have so much great content that maybe only, I would say, less than 1% of your database contacts have seen. And so with technical, you can see who has seen what, and who would maybe even want to see it again, because to be fairly honest, my memory these days is also not that great. So I don't mind reviewing really great content. I just actually, before this podcast, watched a video of a nonprofit, and it just, sorry to be emotional, but it always makes me cry. And I just really needed the feeling of impact. And it was just such a great video that I've actually probably watched it about 10 times. So don't be afraid of that. Like, we in the sector, I think, are sometimes forgetting that there are a lot of great people out there that want to make an impact, and we have that really, really, really great position to do that.
Brilliant. Amazing. Thank you so much, both of you. I found it really interesting that you refer to reusing existing content that's worked successfully in the past, because I think for a lot of charities, at least the ones that we sort of speak to, if they're kind of on the smaller side, anything that you do is a bit of an undertaking, and that could be, you know, financial investment or emotional investment. And the thought of sort of using content that's worked successfully in the past to kind of sort of reuse that in a kind of highlights reel and, you know, kind of get people back onto your side, as it were, is so really, really important. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about that, Brady, please?
Yeah, I mean, to Andrea's point, there's something called the curse of knowledge, where, you know, once you know a piece of information, it's impossible to imagine a world where you don't know that piece of information. And we who work in nonprofits suffer from that, just like all humans. But so we think that, you know, because we've produced a video, everyone in the world has seen that video. They haven't. You know, if we think that people understand the cause and the issue like we do, like, how could you not understand how important food security is for, you know, inner city kids in London or whatever it might be? But a lot of people don't, you know, that's not the world that they live in. They're not working this every single day. So I think that's the overarching thing, is we often talk about fundraisers being from Venus and donors being from Mars. We care about something similar, but we view it from wildly different perspectives. And so if you can just kind of step back, and this is where data and research can help a lot, because it shows you can see, oh, only 1% of our database has actually, you know, watched this video or whatever it might be. So then you feel more confident in sending it out to folks again. But again, we spend all this time creating great content and stories and reporting and annual reports. And then for a lot of us, and we suffer from this in our own marketing, we kind of ship it, send it out, maybe do some advertising, and then we're on to the next thing. But what about the person who just joins your organization 6 months from now? They've never seen that email, right? So you've done all of this hard work. Why not take advantage of it moving forward? especially because you have the benefit from things like Google Analytics. You can see which blog posts get the most organic traffic, which is an indicator of what people are actually searching for. You can find the most open clicked read emails, so you can see this kind of resonated with our people in some way. So that's the extra advantage, is you can go back. Not every piece of content works well, but you can look back and be like, wow, this really did work well. So not only are you kind of reusing something you spent, you know, your hard-earned resources to create, but you also have the ability to see this actually worked well or connected well and reuse it. So it was kind of this weird aha moment where we're like, why don't we do this all the time? Like, why haven't we been doing this more so, you know, for all of our clients and all of our work? And so it sounds so simple, and even explaining is like, yeah, why don't we do this? But we haven't, and we don't see a lot of nonprofits that do it. And I think it's a huge opportunity.
I think one thing that ties directly to this is that we also, even as a small organization, a couple of years I was setting up an organization, one thing that made it so much, the volume of new donors and new newsletter subscribers was often predicted by making it just easier. Just make it frictionless. And if it isn't, like, I was doing a donation today and they asked me, do you want to pay now or do you want to pay later? And I thought that's actually really interesting, because my son is calling me right now and I have to go and I can't find my credit card, so I'll pay later. But I've made the commitment to donate. And so just removing the friction from the experience already makes a huge world of difference. So once you're reducing your content and maybe starting to look at who has seen what, also look at how can I reintroduce that content maybe in a different way. Like, maybe they've seen it on email, but they haven't seen it somewhere else yet. Or maybe they're interested in becoming a recurring giver, and you can make it easier for them to do so by reintroducing a piece of content that you know a lot of other people were interested in and made them convert to recurring giving. I've seen a lot of organizations that started sort of like a membership thing to encourage recurring giving, but there are also a lot of organizations that go more on, like, they have a project that needs monthly input. There's a mission driven reason why they need a recurring giving. These kind of things are quite easy to put in place in terms of making it for your donor just a one-click process or something that is just facilitated for them. So I think that is still something, even for small organizations, that we can explore, like, what are the friction points that we can remove?
It's so interesting that you refer to friction, because sort of just glancing through the study as I was reading in preparation for today's podcast, that seems to be the biggest sort of aspect that turns people away. And I'm just kind of thinking of my own giving or my own, any kind of patterns of online purchasing, or online giving to charities and things. Once you sort of set, and it's particularly in today's day and age, I find that if sort of stumbling block comes up on any website, a page didn't load or a link was broken, I've picked up my phone, I'm onto the next thing, I'm looking at Twitter. So could you tell us a little bit more about friction and how it affects the donor relationship? And I'd like to give this question to Brady, please.
Ooh, you stumbled on one of my absolute favorite subjects. I just recorded a webinar yesterday on this specifically. I talk about friction all the time. So one thing before we dive into friction is every giving equation's value and cost, right? All we're trying to do is communicate more value than perceived value is greater than perceived cost. People will do the action. And friction is a cost factor. And so it's easy to talk about friction, but the biggest thing that drives donations is their understanding of value. Why should I give to you as opposed to another organization or not at all? That's always most important. Sometimes, again, we fool ourselves. Let's just eliminate friction and people will give. It will help people give, but it won't create motivation or a sense of why they should give. So 30% of donation pages in our study were naked donation pages, zero copy or text on them. That assumes that you, by the time you hit that page, you know everything you need to know. You know how you want to give, you know how much you want to give. And you don't. We have ways to influence it. So value comes first, and then we can talk about friction. But there's all different types of friction. We often talk about seven different types of friction within the giving experience. You know, field number, how many form fields are you displaying and are required? That's the big one. What's required? right? If you're requiring me to tell you my birthday that 8% of organizations did, I don't know if I want you to know like my birthday or my cell phone number, you know, that 30% of organizations did. Then we have like field layout friction. If it's like using a lot of vertical space, it feels like it's more work or effort. So just by using horizontal space on form fields, it looks shorter. So we're more likely to start, more likely to complete. We've got form error. So if you've ever filled out something purchasing, you missed a field that was required and you didn't know, you click submit or donate. And then it recycles and says, just kidding, you forgot a piece of information. How frustrating is that? We should be saying you missed a field while you're actually going about it. You've got confusion friction, distracting links, competing calls to action. We found that all the time, about 60% of organizations had distracting links on the donation page that take them away. Next time you buy something from Amazon, once you get into that checkout cart, see what else you can do besides complete your checkout cart. Nothing, right? They know once you're in this flow, you're here to complete your transaction. That's what we need to be thinking about as well. Decision friction. There's so many decisions we actually ask donors to make while they make a donation, not just how much or how often, but do you want to share this information? Is this a tribute gift? Which fund do you want to give to? And when these things are equally weighted and not prioritized, it makes it even harder for us to make decisions. So even just one time monthly, sometimes having a default to one helps us make a decision so we can kind of nudge people towards that. Steps friction, we mentioned in the UK, 86% of organizations had two steps or more in their donation process in this study, something that once you get beyond two steps, you're really running the risk of losing someone or abandoning the process, particularly on a mobile device where this is, you know, kind of compounded. And then device friction, you're talking about giving on a mobile, people are actually moving a lot quicker. So when you have any form of friction is compounded on a mobile device. So yes, it should be mobile friendly, but thinking of the user experience on the donor side, you don't cut the value, but we do need to really be thinking about those friction points. So those are the types of things that we actually tried to put some data behind and research in the study. And it's one of the more easily researchable things, you know, how many form fields were required and stuff. So that's why we spent quite a bit of time focusing on the research study, but it's also one of the easiest ways to improve the online giving experience is kind of removing friction from the donation process.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that. This has been really, really fascinating. And I kind of want to go back and read the report all over again now to see like what new insights I might have. So as we kind of tail off a little bit, are there any kind of ideas or any particular takeaways that you'd like to share with charities listening to us right now? Andrea.
So I think for me, it's three things. First is test, like basic infrastructure. We see that often integration between the website and CRM is not there, but also just test if your form is working, can you make the payment? Test if you receive a thank you email. Often it's something really small that isn't working and easily fixed, but if you don't test, you don't know. For me, the second one is our litmus test. So think about it, if you'll be a relationship, if you try to make new friends and you move maybe to another city or another country, would this work making a new friend? Like it's relatively easy to think about it, and you almost always intuitively know the answer. And for me, the last part is also related to nonprofits themselves. We know that a lot of nonprofits have very few staff members. A lot of nonprofits work with limited resources. So try to make automatic or make use of what technology offers to do all of the things that we don't need your passion for. Like, I don't need to know what your organization is doing to determine the form fields. But I do need that content. I need that reason why I should give. I need that value, as Brady said. And that is something that we as a tech supplier or can't replace. That is your organization and you as a nonprofit employee that have that. So make sure that 80% of your time is on that, because I think that is where we drive real impact.
Brady, thank you so much.
Just remember, there's humans on the other sides of screens. I think that's just a really fundamental thing. You know, when we look at how people interact with donation pages, we treat landing pages similar to conversations with humans. We treat emails similar to conversations when we have in person. And so just there's a temptation to think when we get behind a keyboard or start coding a page, that is just, you know, numbers on the other side, or, you know, people that we don't know. there's humans on the other side, and we can never forget the human side, especially through digital experiences. And so that's, I think, an overarching thing to keep in mind.
Great, thank you so much. So for those of us who would like to go ahead and read the charity study, could you tell us a little bit more about how we could find that, please?
So the study is available at globalonlinefundraising.com, and we made also all of the data available. So if you love browsing through data like we do, you can do your own analysis, and you can download the PDF report on globalonlinefundraising.com. We have more information and blogs that take some of the lessons from the report on salesforce.org, and there you can also learn about our free licenses program.
Thank you very much. And would you like to add anything, Brady?
If you're interested in this research, we do these research studies. We've done about 14 of them now, and we publish them all. You can find them at nextafter.com/resources, but go download the Global Online Fundraising Scorecard.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, both of you. And it just sort of, as we come to the end, it sounds like a sort of very complex relationship between data and that kind of human connection, the passion for your cause, and then finding ways to have what you have to hand, and then tweaking it for your particular campaigns, and sort of remaining agile, kind of keep testing those waters, keep building that relationship. And then the initial kind of welcome journey will inform how you're going to get donors to keep coming back and remain committed to your charity. So I'd like to thank you both, Andrea and Brady. Thank you so much for your time, your expertise, this study that you've contributed to the charity sector. And I think we're going to end it now. Thank you so much again, both of you. Thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. This has been our Charity Digital podcast, and we have so many, many more on this and related subjects. So please do subscribe and give us a listen. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.